Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, folks, to Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and I'm speaking to you from a very lovely day in Houston here. And as you know, if you're regular listeners to the show, and of course there's a wonderful archive on PRN, and almost all the shows are there. Some of the earlier ones got disappeared, as they say, and at some point I'll be putting them on my website, www.technosis.com, which has been a little moribund of late, but so it goes. Anyway, regular listeners will know that we often have occasion to talk about ayahuasca on the show, partly because we're interested in psychedelics in general and as one category of major mind manifestation of those sort of hinterlands of consciousness that confuse, baffle, seduce, attract, and transform us, at least in some cases, and particularly interested in ayahuasca because it's become such an interesting cultural phenomenon, because it asks so many questions about not just the perennial questions about what is reality and are there spirits and these things, but also more political questions about what does it mean to have modern Western world become suddenly very interested in these traditional paths, and is it possible to have a genuine encounter without exploitation? And it sort of raises a lot of issues in the world: globalism, the relationship of North and South, even as it also offers clearly for many, many people a powerful route towards healing and a powerful route towards asking big questions about what's up in this planet. One of the things that happens, of course, is something like ayahuasca becomes more popular and more well known. People go down to the Amazon, or there's underground circuits throughout the West, and people start writing about their experiences, and there starts to become a kind of non-traditional based lore around these substances and what they do and what to expect, and people start to have expectations. And this has happened with all of the introduction of all of the psychedelics into modern Western culture. It happens to some degree even in a place like Brazil, where some of the most powerful ayahuasca sects are not, traditional with a capital T from the jungle, but are themselves mixed up of modern elements and Christianity and a whole range of very contemporary kinds of forces. But what happens today now is that people start to develop their own maps before they have their own encounters. And that's why I'm very, very happy today to have Peter Gorman on. Peter Gorman is certainly my favorite working journalist and writer on issues related to drugs, and who's not only interested in ayahuasca and has tons and tons of decades of experience in the jungle, but has also been a very hard-hitting writer on issues involving the drug war, and has been really on the beat for a very, very long time. I have a great deal of respect for him, both as a political writer and as just a general writer. He had been editor-in-chief of High Times, and so he's been in the field a lot. But one of the things that's remarkable about his constant adventuring and probing is that he was down in the jungle in the early 80s and sort of having experiences and beginning a relationship with ayahuasca long before even hip psychonauts were really keying into the possibilities and the experiences. So he's just written a new book, Ayahuasca in My Blood. And it's the end of the semester here, so I cannot say that I've read the whole thing, but I've read most of it. And it's a great yarn, and it's very illuminating, because Peter Gorman is a very no-bull guy, and it comes through very strong. And I really think it's probably the most interesting personal account of a long apprenticeship and you know, beyond apprenticeship with this particular plant teacher. So I'm really happy to have him on. Before we invite Peter on, I just want to bring on, of course, our co-host, Maja Daou, the White Witch of L.A. How you doing, Maja?
I'm good, Eric. How are you?
So what do you think? Is there any sign of the ayahuasca trend, and I use that word very intentionally, abating there? Like, you're in Los Angeles. You're at sort of ground zero of restless New Age spiritual tourism.
Here.
So what's it look like over there?
It's in full effect. I mean, I see it and hear about it constantly from people, and it kind of bums me out. And I had given a lecture on, like, kind of the lashback that happened after Carlos Castaneda, you know, all these, like, eco-tourists or, like, ethno-botany tourists went down to Mexico and, like, stole all the shaman's peyote cactuses, and they all got bummed and, like, put out a message, like, please stop taking our cactuses. And, I mean, now there's, like, organized groups and stuff that go down there, but I think there's this thing that happens where in cultures like Los Angeles, it becomes this lust after the strange, where they think, like, this foreign exotic ayahuasca is going to solve all of their spiritual problems, and it's like kind of making people turn it into this food of the gods or elixir when they're just using it more kind of like an escapee sort of thing and as a trendsetter than actually to use it shamanically like a lot of the shamans might advocate for. I'm not saying this is true always, and certainly there are some groups that definitely do it that way, but I mean, whenever we're talking about a plant substance, Los Angeles alone has plenty of DMT available plants that are here. There's really not a reason to go, like, off into La La Land to go searching for it when, I mean, I kind of think a lot of that stuff is already here. And literally, DMT is in our own brains. So, I mean, there's something to be said for this lust after the strange and exotic, which seems to be hitting a lot of folks in L.A. about that.
Well, I'm sure we'll get to some of these issues later on in the show, but for now I just want to bring on Peter Gorman. Peter, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Well, thanks for having me, Eric. I appreciate it a lot. Glad to be here.
So I wanted to just to go back and you know, as I said, it's I'm really happy you sat down and cranked this book out. It's, you know, it's a big deal to sit and write a book in general and to write about your own life. It raises all sorts of issues and challenges. But I really think it's an important and very engaging story, partly because of who you are, but also like when you really began your sort of engagement with the jungle and its teachings. So could you start off for us, like, why and when did you first go to the jungle, and how did you kind of stumble into to this plant teacher, and particularly in light of how different our ideas are now than they were in the 1980s?
Okay. I'll tell you the truth. I was in love with the Mexican Lacandon jungle and jungle in Guatemala and Belize. And the woman I lived with at the time in the very early 80s thought, he's probably going to end up in the Amazon. He's going to die down there. So she bought me a book called Headhunters of the Amazon by Updegraff, written about 100 years ago, about a fellow from Buffalo, New York, who went to visit a friend in Ecuador and ended up getting caught up in Indian wars and rubber baron wars, etc., which meant I had to go exactly there, which was the Yaveri River, the border of Peru and Brazil. But the stepping off point for that was Iquitos. So it's a waterlocked city. There's no roads in or out. You need to fly in or come in on a boat. And a couple of friends got talked into coming, and we did the mountains with them, and then we went down to the jungle. By the time we hit the jungle, and this little smarmy guy came over, met us shortly after we left the airport, and said, you know, I'm a guide. I'll take you out to the jungle, real jungle, full jungle. I was so fed up with guides from the rest of my time in Peru that I said, I blew him off, and I told my friends, there's just got to be a boat. Let's just get a boat. We'll go somewhere. We'll go out into the jungle, and we'll see what's what. Well, we did. We ended up in a place called Rakena where nobody would take us to the jungle. They were all terrified of Indians and snakes and ghosts, etc. And when we made our way back to Iquitos 2 weeks later, here's this smarmy little man. And he says, now are you ready to go to the jungle? We said we went. He said, no, you didn't. No one would take you out in the jungle. They're afraid. I'll take you out. And then he mentioned the word ayahuasca. And we said, what's that? And he said, hallucinogen. And we said, what are you talking about? We had never heard of this. In any event, we ended up going out with him for 3 days, and we ended up getting an opportunity to drink ayahuasca. We had no idea what it was, and nothing to say what was going to happen at all, so we had no preconceived notions. So we drank this awful burnt grapefruit infused with tobacco-smelling muck and at a fellow named Alphonse's house, maybe 7 or 8 hours upriver from the town of Iquitos, and the next thing you know, nothing seemed to happen. We're just sitting here on an open platform hut, sitting out there, and suddenly I heard this tremendous rumbling. It sounded like a river going in reverse. Water cascading up and up and up this mountainside. And I turned and I realized it was Alphonse, and he was vomiting wildly. Nothing was coming out, but he was making these vomiting sounds. This enormous geyser was coming out of him, and I thought, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. I wonder what that's about. And a few minutes later, it was coming out of me. And it was like, my goodness, okay, this is what ayahuasca is. And so I heaved and heaved and heaved, and I finished heaving. I thought, well, that was interesting. That was fascinating. I don't know what that was about, but it was certainly fascinating. And then I lay down, and the minute I lay down, I ended up seeing a bird. And I thought, I've never seen a bird that close. And the next thing you knew, I didn't know this term. I didn't know the term associating with an animal. But I was associating with the bird. And then I was the bird. And it blew my mind when I realized every feather we moved was a separate muscle I had to move. I thought, oh my goodness, oh, this is amazing. And I flew with that bird for a long time, and until we tipped off the face of the earth, so to speak, and dove down, down, down to what looked like a tiny little line, turned out to be a stream. We plucked a fish out of the stream. The bird soared, and then the bird bit the fish, and I almost choked trying to get it down my throat. And that was, that textile feeling, moving those wing muscles and trying to swallow a fish, let me know this was not something I was making up. This was amazing. And I determined to come back and find out, what the heck is this? What is this magic? And fortunately, I had this amazing guide in Moises Torres Viena, who really was a jungle survival specialist and spent a long time teaching me jungle survival. But he also taught me about ayahuasca by bringing me to a fellow who became my teacher, Julio Herrera. And one of the key things he taught me, which your West Coast partners mentions, is that what Moises taught me was that ayahuasca was a part of the jungle, not apart from the jungle. It was part and parcel of daily life for the people who lived on the river, and I got to know that year after year after year as I would come back. Moises and I would say, Moises, let's walk to Brazil. And he would say, okay, but we can't walk to Brazil until we drink ayahuasca. You need the ayahuasca in you to be able to have the good night vision, to clean your stomach out, to make sure that you are just emotionally clean enough that the scary ghosts, etc., the spirits of the plants and snakes are not going to want to attack you as we walk 7 or 8 days across the jungle. So we would drink ayahuasca in preparation for the walk, and then we would drink ayahuasca when we came back to thank those things. My teacher Julio grew as well. But it was always as a part of the jungle, of the experience. You know, we're going to... Julio saw it that way as well. He was just a poor little fisherman, and people would come to him with sick babies one day, and he'd have to just stop what he's doing, stop fishing, and sing for a sick baby for 3 hours. And when he was finished, the baby would be better, and he would waltz, the family would waltz away and maybe give him some fish because he didn't have any to eat that day because they took him away from fishing. But that to me was my introduction.
So how did you, at what point as you started to go down there, you become fascinated, it is exotic, it is this other world, you're making encounters with different kinds of cultures that are, are not from wherever, the Northeast or wherever you're, I don't know if you're from
not
Brooklyn.
From New York, where I was from, yeah.
Yeah. Then at what point did you start to go, hey, I'm here too. Like, this is kind of a place that I am, that my, the connections I'm making with people, the way in which I'm engaging this place, you know, it became kind of more real or actual for you as a part of your life, and whether your experience with the plant medicine had something to do with that.
Yes, and it all was wrapped together. Really, it was the first 3 days made me want to come back, and the following year I came back and spent 30 days in the jungle with Moises, really just deep jungle, him teaching me survival techniques, building houses. He threw away all of our food, and I refused to eat the meat or fish because I was like, well, we're not gonna, I didn't come here to kill endangered species, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and then he politely threw away all of our food, which left me, you know, after the third day of not eating anything, except a few leaves that he found for me. I now know how to find plenty of food, but at the time I didn't. And so he just feed me half a dozen of leaves. I stole a couple of birds that he had on the spit. It really, it was part of my life from the first time I was there. And by the third year, I was going down 3 months a year. I wound up, you know, I mean, in the early 90s. Well, I'll tell you, what really happened for me was, as a journalist, you know, you always need an angle that nobody else has. I had run into a group of Indians called, or indigenous, called the Matsez. And I got a few throwaway things from them. I mean, I call them throwaway. They were like an arrow that was used in hunting that broke. And I thought, you know, Moises charges me so much money. I wonder, there's got to be a way to find out. Are these kind of tourist indigenous, or are these the real deal? And, you know, as any decent journalist, you come up with an idea. And I said, okay, the only way I'm going to find out is let's offer to give all this stuff to the Museum of Natural History. When I go there and they laugh at me, I'll know they're tourist Indians, and I won't go to the jungle anymore with Moises. Well, I went there, and they said, can we have all this stuff? We don't have anything from them. We're building a new Hall of South American Peoples. Well, then that gave me a purpose, and it gave me assignments from people like Penthouse and Omni to go down to the jungle. So I began getting paid to go to the jungle, you know, fairly regularly. And from there, I ended up, a little company called Shaman Pharmaceutical opened up. And the museum would send my material to the Bronx Botanical Gardens, if it was plant material, for to be assayed. And Bronx Botanical Gardens always sent it back to the museum saying, this guy doesn't know how to collect plants. Well, I ran into one of the fellows at the Botanical Gardens, Stephen King, at Albert Einstein Convention, a convention at Albert Einstein School, and where they were announcing the beginning of this new company, Shaman Pharmaceutical. And he said, if you're willing to learn how to collect plants, we will send you down there on a plant collecting trip. And it was an amazing opportunity. I was taught for 2 weeks in private lessons up at the Bronx Botanical Gardens how to collect and press plants. And then I went down to the jungle, and I had to put a boat together, and I'd never done that. I mean, a boat that's going to go out in the middle of nowhere, the Brazilian-Peruvian border, which is really, really no man's land at that time. And I wound up marrying the woman I hired to come along as a cook. And so then it wasn't just part of my life. It was like, well, now my family's down here, and now I bought a little house down there. And she had two boys, and I adopted them, and it took us a year to get them out. And I was working at High Times magazine, you know, 9 months a year, but I was working down there 3 months a year. And we eventually moved there in late 97 for 3 or 4 years, opened a little bar on the toughest block I could find in Iquitos, because I thought that would be much more interesting. It was on a real rough port block. And we had some good fights in that place. And
well, you're clearly a seasoned experiencer before you went down to the jungle, and I'm curious how your encounter with the plant ally and your experiences over the years really changed your sense of what was possible through the ingestion of substances, whether they're, you think of them as plant allies or as drugs or whatever the metaphor is. Clearly, there's something special about ayahuasca, perhaps simply being in the jungle as part of your experience. But how did it shift your sense of like what was possible
with the
mind?
There's a good question. I had certainly done my share of LSD and anything else you can imagine. It was part of my life. But when I encountered ayahuasca, I encountered something that showed me, didn't just let me know that there was a life force in everything. But let me see that there was a life force, a will, desires. You know, I mean, I look at the door has an opinion about things. Now, we don't speak to that door. We can't normally reach that door. How do you communicate with a door? Heck, it was, you know, it was foliage 20 million years ago, and now it's a piece of plastic, right? Doesn't mean it doesn't have a life force. And ayahuasca, here's the deal with ayahuasca. Imagine, I mean, the simplest way I can put it is, imagine a dog whistle. You know, you blow it, you don't hear it, I don't hear it, the cat doesn't hear it. The dog yelps with pain. It hears it. So just because we didn't see it doesn't mean it wasn't there. So ayahuasca, similarly, or, you know, I mean, somehow similarly, broadens the spectrum of what we normally see, touch, feel, taste. And in so doing, it allows us to meet an awful lot of the spirits, the real, I don't know what else to call them. I mean, I call them spirits, and I guess most people do. And that sounds like something with a form. And yes, we have to give it a form because our brains demand, you know, to not go insane. Our brains demand that we give shape to the shapeless. Call them spirits for lack of a real word for them. But to be able, and suddenly you find yourself, you can communicate very well with all sorts of spirits. And you really, not just that, but they, once you open that door, it doesn't close. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of, there's thousands of people living in my house at a given time. And my son, Marco, who first drank at 14, down in the Amazon where he was born, where it was part and parcel of his culture, you know, as he put it, you know, Dad, before last night, I was afraid of the dark because I thought that's when ghosts came out. Now that I did ayahuasca, I realized they're here all the time. They're everywhere. The room is packed with them. I don't think I'll be afraid of the dark. And he was never afraid of the dark after that. Unfortunately, the codicil is, once you open that door, it never quite closes again. So Marco, although he's moved out, when he lived here or when he stays here at night sometimes, will still, at age 23, call me, Dad, would you just tell him to shut up? And I've got to go in the room, and I'll see the spirits of fellas. Out. Either talk to Marco so he can hear it, or talk much quieter, or just leave the room. You can't, you know, he's trying to get some sleep. So, I mean, so what is it? How has it shifted? It allows a regularly pretty normal, sane person to be able to look at the car when the car doesn't want to work and just say, fella, do you want to be a lawn ornament or do you want to be a car? Your choice. And then the car will just go. And both my cars have over 300,000 miles on them, and they work like charms, knock on wood. And, you know, I mean, that's, what does it do? It allows you to coax, you know, coax the dog to be more dog-like, the car to be more car-like, the kids to be more kid-like, and a lot more joy in your own life for, you know, remembering 20 times a day to look down, look around, and just say, oh, I'm seeing you, how are you? You know, to the tree or to the rock or whatever.
Well, and I mean, that's a really amazing point that you make, and that's really, I think, about viewing reality as it really is. And for you, you were able to go to the jungle and have a context for that experience. But, I mean, what do you think about these people who have no context for that and don't understand how to talk to the ghosts and get kind of, like, overwhelmed by it, and the kind of difference between, like, that schizophrenic experience where it becomes horrifying and overwhelming, and the ability to actually, like, you know, recognize your car ghost and have a conversation with it and not get taken over with it? Like, what do you think is the delineating factor to keep people on the healthy side of conversing with these ghosts as opposed to, like, falling victim to them?
Well, I mean, I think there are a few key navigational tools that, I mean, if it was up to me, everybody in the world would come on my two trips a year where I only take 12 people. So not the whole world would fit. But I think that would give them the right context. And obviously there's a lot of people who have centers and retreats down there. Even those, I sort of question as, you mean you come from New York and you get on a plane and the next day you're drinking ayahuasca? Where's your context?
Yeah.
You don't even know how to shop in town yet, much less, you know what I mean? So, but for me, if you're going to do it, and even with my guests down in the jungle, I really make it clear, take three very basic navigational tools, and Alan Shoemaker turned me on to two of them. One, when we, I mean, this part's my own, when we pull apart the curtain that separates, you know, the very flimsy curtain, when we broaden our senses just enough to be aware of these other spirits in the area, imagine it's a giant wall between us and them, but with a curtain on. Now, we pull the curtain down, suddenly there's a million families looking out and saying, huh, what happened to the wall? And they're looking in at us as well as we're looking in at them. And in that moment, they're curious about us. And so when you get into the ayahuasca, you get into the ayahuasca dream, you're going to see these spirits. You're going to see these ghosts. And you're going to have to compartmentalize them to be able to deal with them. So you're going to give them faces. Some of them will be scary faces. Some will be funny faces. If you see one that's hanging around and he doesn't, like, it's kind of bothering you, but he's not doing anything, you know, blow him away. Just blow. And they'll disappear. If that simply will disappear, and that will alleviate half the stress of the event right there. Secondly, if they don't disappear, they're probably there to teach you something. In which case, take a quick moment to try to remember and remind yourself before you even go into the space to ask, are you my teacher? And if they say yes or they nod, ask them, what do you need to teach? What do you want to teach me? And whatever they do, if they say follow me or if they say jump in that hole, do it. They don't have a lot of time for you. They're moving on to the next person. You know, who said, you know, who knows who gave them the order to teach you something or what compelled them to want to teach you something. Often something you could use in this world. But, you know, you can't sit there deliberating and say, but is it going to hurt? Am I free? No. Just do it or you missed your chance.
So have you experienced in some of your teachings and your trips, have you ever had anyone on your watch, like, really have a bad trip and have something kind of dangerous happen?
Nothing. I've never had anything dangerous happen to anyone. I've had, it's hard to, the way I do it, I prep these people so well, you know, I take them for five, it's the fifth night before I let them have ayahuasca. So they've been in the jungle, they've been on riverboats, they've been night canoeing so that they have the sounds of the jungle in them. They've been in a swamp up to their knees in mud. They've already learned to hate me so much that they've become a cohesive group, you know, in hating me. But my team of 12 people were all born where we go. They're all my late teacher's sons, daughters, grandkids, and we outnumber the guests, you know. So by the time it's time, you know, we simply take care of their bodies. You know, they're not allowed to walk off that platform to go vomit without us holding their arms. They can't walk off to the bathroom. They can't walk past the space where they can hear the coronado singing. You know, that's just, and we'll physically stop them, you know. Do you have some times where people get intimidated? Sure you do. Sure. And we try to stay out of it, but if we have to, we'll walk somebody off the little platform hut. Pardon me. And ask them what the problem is. And sometimes they'll say, this person, they're so big, they're so scary. And then I'll give them the third tip, which I give them beforehand, but I'll remind them. These spirits come from the jungle. In the jungle, the indigenous are very bravo, very aggressively brave in order to protect their little camps. So if you show up at a camp in the old days, when I first used to in 85, 86, they start shooting arrows at you. What you do is keep your canoe just outside the range of where you're going to get killed, and you start screaming at them. And when they're out of arrows, you charge as if you're going to kill them. And when you do and you stand off, then you become friends. So if a spirit is intimidating and terrifying somebody, I just remind them, you have no corporal body. Become 300 feet tall. The spirit will be a little midget. And at that point, their fear disappears as a rule. Now, does everybody who's holding ceremony all over the United States, or even in Peru, do they have any idea of any of these little techniques to help you get through? I don't know. I think it would be, for me, very intimidating. The first time I did it, of course, I had no help, you know? So, but I didn't have one of those experiences that was overwhelming. I had an experience that was overwhelmingly fantastic with that bird. When people have these very terrifying experiences. I mean, I think those three techniques I just gave you really do help a lot to eliminate some of the fear and ground you in that right moment. Because in the end, the medicine's going to teach you. She's going to give you a lot of stuff, whether you know it or not, because you're not going to process it for the next 5 or 10 years, if ever. You know, completely. Even if you don't know you got it, you got it. But at the same time, what I love about those techniques
is just that they acknowledge the dynamics of the spirit realm, but also the way that the spirit realm does not work exactly like our realm. And yet they're a lot more handy than a lot of, you know, like it may be. If you have a great curandero, perhaps his song or his rattle or whatever instrument he's going to use or the special feather or whatever it is might do the trick as well. But what you're describing is something is actually like tools. It's more like jungle survival. It's like, hey, you're out there. Here's your tools. And it's a very pragmatic kind of shamanism, if you know what I mean.
Well, and, you know, it was Julio who taught me once when he I got into a space where one of these somebody so very enormous, it turned out that his cape was the cape that we call the sky, and there were little cuts in it like where the sun was, which was, you know. But if he took the cape away, it would all just be whiteness, and it was, you know, blinding. And he asked me to follow him, and I started to, and then I said, I'm not ready. I can't do this. I just can't do this. I'm just totally scared to death. I'm pissing myself. And he. You know, he said, well, come back when you're ready to learn. And then I rarely talk to Julio about those experiences, but in that case, Julio said, what happened, or something to that effect? And I said, well, this is a great big guy. I was so scared that he said, what happened? I said, well, I told him I wasn't ready. And Julio just laughed and shook his head and said, Peter, I sent him. He's one of my guardians. I sent him to teach you and be a guardian for you. And you send him away. I can't. And he said, you know, do you have any balls? Grab them. Next time you run into him, become bigger than he is. He's the universe. You become everything. Then you won't be so big and scary. And then he told me a story anyway. So we need to take a break here,
and we'll come back with these great stories. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Eric Davis. We're talking with Peter Gorman, and we'll be right back after these messages.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, Progressive Radio fans. I'm Betsy Rosenberg, and I do a program here on the network called The Green Front, as in reporting from the green front lines. That's where I've been for more than a decade, covering a beat that I think is fun, fascinating, fact-filled, and sometimes even kind of funny. Or not, when you consider the implications of our world-class denial here in America. The Green Front is an ostrich-free zone, though, where I select the most interesting and passionate eco-innovators out there and bring them to you live each Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern. So join me as we wake up America with the activists, authors, experts, and ordinary citizens out there making an extraordinary green difference.
A little of Ella, a touch of the blues, and a voice that mellowed in the Lesotho Mountains is just how Dee Phillips from Cosmopolitan Magazine describes CeeDee's voice. Tony Award nominee and winner of several top industry awards, CeeDee is the first Southern African woman to win Britain's most coveted Ivor Novello Award for International Achievement in Musical Theater. Join the continuing journey of CeeDee's music from her beginnings in the African mountain kingdom of Lesotho to the international stage with a roster of world-class stars including Sting, Elton John, and Madonna. Listen to CeeDee's Grace Notes live from New York City every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Dr. Cheryl Selman from What Women Must Know. You can listen to me every Monday at 2 p.m. I am a naturopathic doctor, author, psychotherapist, lecturer, and passionate women's health advocate. And this is a show all about holistic perspectives and solutions for women's health matters. We have a chance for explorations and in-depth conversations into subjects that women must know. This is all about empowering women of all ages to get truthful information, as well as the chance to explore safe and holistic solutions for women's unique health challenges. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self.
Are you asking questions about the fate of our planet, your spiritual direction, and how to find meaning in a fast-paced society? Voices of Wisdom with John Jeanette is here to answer those questions and more. Tune in every Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to hear sacred activists and teachers exploring the meaning of contemporary culture. The show is produced by Wisdom University with regular commentary by Jim Garrison and Will Tagle. I'm your host, John Jeanette, and I look forward to your questions.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Zawu, and we're here with Eric Davis. We're talking with Peter Gorman about ayahuasca, a very popular word that's sort of little understood around these parts, I think, and it's very great to have Peter here telling us about his experience. And his new book is called Ayahuasca in My Blood. And Peter, I was just wondering, you know, I mean, this is your life. Like, you had that experience with ayahuasca, and now, I mean, you know, you're in it. You're in the jungle. You're in, like you say, the ayahuasca is in your blood. And I was just curious, what do you think, if you could put into context the purpose for ayahuasca, for someone like New York, like you said, someone that goes from New York to the boat, ingests it in the jungle for like 5 days and then returns to New York. Like, what kind of feedback have you gotten for what effect that has on people's consciousness or changes their lives, or how does bringing that jungle back into the cities, like, what do you think the kind of purpose or meaning to that is?
Well, I would say, interestingly, of all the people I've ever taken out, and I really, let me speak for me because I don't want to speak for somebody else, of the people I've taken out, number one, I'm in touch probably with almost all of them once or twice a year. Number two, I would say 20%, 10%, I mean, but a legitimate percentage, come back and get the divorce that they wanted for 10 years and were afraid to get. Or marry the person they wanted to marry and were afraid to ask. Or quit the job. You know, I mean, not unusual at all that people come back and 3 months later, because I tell them, if you're my client, you're my client forever, 3 months later they think, well, now you got me in a big fix. I just closed down my whole job because I realize it doesn't, my company, because it doesn't fit with the way the world should work. Now what should I do? And I've got to sit with them and go through them with them what they might do with their life now that they've shut that down. So it makes enormous changes in people's lives. The work this stuff does is very big. You know, again, not everybody's ready for it. I don't think. I mean, who the heck am I to say that? Maybe I'm phrasing that wrong. I think it comes on as a big surprise to a lot of people just how big the change will be. You'll be you. But if you suck going in, you'll probably suck a little less. And if you go in as a fairly evolved, wonderful, fantastic human being, ayahuasca will probably polish you up, you know, to a high gleam. Does that happen with somebody on the first time? No, people often drink 8 or 10 times and don't, you know, seem to have any effect that they can discern.
Hmm.
But maybe there was a tumor that was going to grow that didn't grow because the ayahuasca took care of it before it had a chance to start. You know, something simple. I mean, a good ayahuasquero takes care of so many physical illnesses for you. I mean, a good ayahuasquero, a good shaman, you know, is just an amazing thing to a person to be around. Man or woman, they move your body around, they fix things. I mean, so many clients come down, they've got permanent problems, and, you know, 2 weeks later, the problem's gone. You know, and they never get it again. They call me 5 years later, still don't have it. I had one woman who insisted on coming down. to die in the jungle. She was very well known in the academic world in Australia. And I kept saying, no, I don't want you down here. You're going to die and get out of here, you know. In any event, she finally just, you know, twisted my arm. And I said, okay, on condition that you don't die in the jungle, that you let me give you at least 6 more months. Not me, but Julio and the medicine. 6 more months. Well, she came down. She hated me. She hated the trip. Julio worked on her all night, and that night he let me see his shakapa, his leaf bundle rattle, as it just shot light all through it. He let me see the work that he was doing. He was just moving stuff around on her insides, burning certain things out and lighting other things up. Well, the next day she hated me. She hated the trip. She wanted to go home early. And Julio said, wait. Let me, ayahuasca doesn't really cure, you know, cancer, so let me have my son make this stuff. So he had his son collect some material, and he made her this witch's brew, and he said, you drink 2 ounces every morning, 2 ounces at night until it's gone, and then you'll be better. Well, the woman didn't believe it, but fortunately, she didn't die on my watch, and I sent her off to Brazil with her boyfriend. I mean, this is a 50-year-old woman, and she called me about 6 months later, saying, I hated the trip. You sucked. You're the worst guide in the world. It was horrible. You had me swimming in the river, and here I'm dying of cancer, and I'm now on the slopes of Italy riding around at a Vespa. 6 months later, she calls again. She's in India. 6 months later, she calls. That went on for probably 5 years. You know, she got 5 years more than the 2 weeks she had, according to her doctor. So, I mean, that's the curandero working on her. You know what I mean? That's him saying, okay, this is what I saw in ayahuasca. Now, one interesting thing I think that we need to note here, you know, traditionally the guests don't do the drinking of ayahuasca. My mother-in-law and father-in-law each, and my wife, each drank when they came of age, when they were going to get married, when there was some immense tumult in their life, 2 or 3 times in their life. But normally you go to the ayahuasquero, tell him what the issue is, and he drinks. Goes up to the other plane of reality, sees where the disturbance is up there, comes back down, and tells you the solution, whether it's for illness or, you know,
well,
emotional.
Do you think that's because the curandero has been trained, like you said, in some of the techniques that you use, like that they've been trained in these techniques, so they do the ayahuasca instead of having the patient do it, and then by contagion they do the healing?
Well, if you got to remember that, yes, I mean, they do it because they know how to navigate that space. They know the spirits. They know the healing, the spirits of the plants. And you, in South America, largely, I can't swear for everybody, but largely, physical illness or psychological problems, et cetera, on this plane are viewed as the result of a disturbance on another plane of reality. The average fisherman, Joe, can't access that, so the ayahuasquero does. Or it could be a death tornado, or, you know, whoever, whatever the plants, the person, spirits, the person might work with. They access that other level of reality to see what the disturbance is and come back down. Now, one of my favorite stories, and if you guys, Eric, you probably read this in the early part of the book, so I apologize for boring you. One of the best and earliest explanations I ever saw for how ayahuasca really works, a fellow came up the river, the Julios. It was very early on in my time with Julio. And he swore that somebody was sending him negativity, you know, brujeria, negative stuff. And Julio says, why? And he said, well, every time I sell my chicken and my yuca in town, you know, I fall down, I get hurt, I break my ankle, I break my knee, I break my leg, I can't work for 6 months. Somebody is doing that. They're so jealous of. You have to find out who's doing it, and then we have to take care of them. So he said, okay. So he drank that night, and I drank that night, and the fellow didn't drink. And then when it was all over, Julio came out of his dream chuckling. And the man said, laugh, what are you laughing about? And he said, well, you know, there's good news, there's bad news. He said, well, what's that? Who is it? Who's doing it? He said, nobody's doing it to you. What I saw was that every time you get money from selling your chickens and your yuca, you go to that little cantina in Herrera with the 2 steps, and the bottom step is broken, and you get drunk, and then you walk out, you trip on the bottom step, and you fall down and hurt yourself. So you have 2 choices if you want to remedy the situation. You can either stop getting drunk when you sell your chickens and your yuca, or you can fix the damn step. That's ayahuasca. You know, that's really what ayahuasca is, and that's a traditional use, as simple as that.
So here's the question I got for you. I think that like Maj's questions came out of a concern that a lot of people have, that there's some kind of dilution in the message, or there's just this kind of exploitation or this kind of tourist industry that's happening. And I'm getting a sense from you that you believe that while all of that kind of icky stuff is definitely going to be happening, that there really is the possibility here at this point in our very peculiar history to have real encounters that really change people. Yeah, I mean, just sort of like reflect. Do you feel that that's happening for a reason? Do you have a sense that like that the plant, you know, that the jungle has a kind of plan in this? Is this part of a bigger plan, or is it just an opportunity that now more people outside of the jungle have?
We get into real tricky ground here because we get a little bit of my ego here. The first story nationally that was ever that I know of nationally printed on ayahuasca in, at the time, a major magazine, was my story on ayahuasca, Mind-Bending Drug of the Amazon, as it was horribly titled on the cover. But it was the first cover story in ayahuasca. So, you know, I sort of caused some of this, because I caused some other people who caused other people who caused other people, and boom, boom. And, of course, Terrence McKenna began writing about it the same time I did, and he had his whole West Coast on fire, and I had all the High Times people starting to talk about it. So I'm real sort of sometimes feel guilty about it. I think in the end, it's not a bad thing. I don't think most people will ever get around to, number one, it's never going to become a party drug. Nobody gets laid when you're puking all over somebody. It just doesn't happen. And, you know, so I think it's still going to stay in, even if they're large circles, even if it's an awful lot of curiosity seekers, I think most people will, within a few times of doing it, either realize that this is a spirit which has her own demands. I mean, she makes demands on you. You know, you don't just get it and she heals you. Well, I mean, she might for a while, and then she suddenly starts talking to you and saying, okay, so this is what you're going to do for me because what I've been doing for you. And at that point, I think most people simply will disappear, and they won't use it anymore. They will have been affected. They will have had some great healing, whether they know it or not. But I don't think they'll continue with it. And I think an awful lot of the curiosity seekers do use it once or twice on the weekend, or they heard about a circle and they go. And if they don't really get the fireworks, then I think, you know, they end up, they may walk away disappointed. And so that might be another reason for them to stop. So I think the circles will continue for a while, but I don't know if there's going to be anything horribly tragic about it, as long as people don't drink it while they're on SSRIs or something, you know? And I don't think, I don't think it's going to be a horrible thing. I think an awful lot of people will get a taste for it, and that might lead them to go to some place like Iquitos. And Iquitos or Pucallpa now have enough retreat centers where you're not going out and trying to find indigenous who use ayahuasca, who don't, you know, regularly give it to white people, is it very difficult. You know, you have to do what I did, and that's just spend, you know, I mean, I lucked into Moises, but, you know, I mean, you really would have to get super lucky or spend years tooling around the jungle a few months a year to run into those people. So most people will go to retreat centers that are organized for drinking ayahuasca, and I don't think that's going to be too horrible to the locals. It does take a few ayahuascaeros out of their communities and put them in, you know, these retreat centers. On the other hand, it also encourages apprenticeships for the younger kids who see that their dad is no longer being laughed at as the old drunk. He's now the old drunk who gets these white people to give him a bunch of money and treat him with the utmost respect. So, it's, you know, there's positive and negative to it. Does that answer it at all?
Yeah, no, that's a good answer. I had another question on, you know, in your book, you talk about, you know, violent situations happen. You already mentioned the jungle is a macho place. There is, you know, the indigenous tensions in these, you know, that you run into these characters on a boat, and you, in a way that the snake spirit that you felt you've connected with helps you kind of stand up to that situation. And, you know, and of course, on a more geopolitical level, there's all sorts of violence being done across the planet, and also, you know, even in the jungle, in terms of these global forces coming in and transforming the situation, et cetera, et cetera. And I know that for some people there's a real hope and a dream that there's some kind of way to enter into a more peaceful world, and that nature really holds a sort of possibility of peace. And yet, if you look at the reality of shamanism, you look at reality of life in jungle, it's a very strife and stress-filled place, just like everywhere else on the planet. I'm wondering with you, especially because you're a rough and tumble guy, how your sense of the violent side or that strifeful side of reality of being a being on Earth, how it's changed or maybe not changed by your experience with ayahuasca.
I mean, on a personal level. I mean,
either way, you know, just how you see things. You know, is it just is it more? You know, it's another world where, in a way, the same kind of tensions and alliances and conflicts go on? Or has there been a sense of, like, a deeper understanding of how everything fits together?
No, I think that while a place like Peru, now I've spent time in Brazil and Ecuador and Colombia, but primarily in Peru, a place like Peru is not very macho to begin with. This is not a country where people walk around with chips on their shoulder. Nonetheless, this is a place where everything is taken as personal insult. You can't in Peru, when you call somebody, like imagine you put your arm out and put your palm up and say, like, Joey, come here, right? You can't do that in Peru. That's an insult. You have to put your palm down and wave your fingers kind of sissy-like and say, like, you know, which indicates when you have a moment, I'd love to see you. So, you know, if you wave it up, it means you're my slave. Get over here. So everything is taken as an insult, and so there's a lot of violence. I know 10, 15 men who've had their heads blown off down there by each other. You know, somebody just gets mad and walks in and takes a shotgun and blows somebody away, and if it happens on the river, there's no repercussion. You know, very, very infrequently that anybody would bother to. Everybody knows who did it, and it doesn't matter. Well, he had it coming. The guy slept with his wife. He blew him away. That's fine. So I think there's a certain degree of harshness down there, and I think when we bring our Western harshness down there, it just really gets much, much worse when we decide that we're going to, you know, the oil exploration is just horrific, you know, what that does to peoples, and, you know.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, my grandfather was a petroleum geologist for Exxon, and he went all over South America just doing that. You know, he would find the rocks that indicated there was oil present. So he was part of that, you know, kind of mission to find oil in those places. I mean, he was in Ecuador, Peru, you know, Colombia, all over there, and he would go in the jungle with his machete and his team of men. I mean, it was like the Wild West, like, you know, like you were saying. And I mean, I just read Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy. I don't know if you read that book or not, but it's kind of similar. Like, when you go into these indigenous people's place, I mean, obviously for them it was for oil and for taking stuff, but I mean, there is that kind of ethnobotany contingency where they are taking the plants and exploiting some of the resources a little bit. I mean, it's not like, you know, the Corinderos are getting paid for these retreats and stuff, but how do you think about that analogy, like kind of like Wild Westy with the Native American?
Well, I don't think it's anything nearly as violent as the Native Americans. I think the population also is so much tinier with indigenous. Even the Mestizo Riverine population in the jungle area is very scattered, very small. The rubber boom was when that horror really went on in that, you know, in that place. Now, even the oil exploration is not, I mean, here's the problem with, you know, for instance, with the logging operation. The logging operation, it's hard. The trees are scattered, you know, the trees that are worth taking out, they're scattered, and most of the logging is not. In Brazil, sometimes they do this huge, you know, operations most of the time in Peru, in northwestern Amazonia anyway. It's groups of three or four guys go out, and they spend 3 weeks, and they cut 20 trees and cut those into 10 trunks each, make a raft, and float that back to Iquitos, where they turn it into little, what they call chiple, little plastic, you know, plywood. So they've taken this gorgeous stuff. But half the trees won't float. So, you know, even that's not the biggest problem. The problem is if those guys set up a camp, then, and it's a permanent camp, then it becomes a little village. And around that camp now, somebody's going to come to be their cook. Somebody's going to come to be their prostitute. Somebody's going to come to be, you know, you know what I'm saying? And then suddenly you've exploited a new territory. You've opened up a place that had always traditionally been closed. And then, you know, if there's only one tree that makes the fruit that the certain wild boar likes, like the, you know, aguaje tree, and then if that boar doesn't come on that hectare anymore because you've cut down that tree, now all the animals that lived off that boar don't come there either. You know, and so you really change the whole ecosystem at once. That's a very subtle sort of violence, but it's still a, you know, a kind of violence because it shifts things permanently.
Hey, Peter, we only got a couple more minutes here, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to tell people about where they can find your stuff online or more information about your book or your tours or anything.
All right, thanks. I have a pgorman.com website, which talks about my tours and has book connections. Amazon.com sells my book. Kindle sells my book. And it sells very well. Maybe 8 or 10 bookstores around the country sell it. But I published it myself at Gorman Bench Press because I had to get it off my chest. I think it's a good read. Tours are available, 10 people a couple times a year. And out into the deep jungle, as long as you're willing to get your hands real, real deep in the mud, I'm the right guy for you. There's also a couple of other books that are out there now that are very, very good on the subject. And one in particular is Singing to the Plants by Steve Beyer, which if you want to know about shamanism in northwest Amazonia, he's the encyclopedic sort of guy. I'm more...
we had him on the show.
Oh, did you? Okay. So he's terrific. But so my book is from the bird's eye view of drinking ayahuasca and living, being part of the jungle. I never, you know, not living in it full time, but being in it for months at a time. I don't know what else to tell you. I appreciate you having me on the show.
I think that will do, man. I'm really happy you were on the show. Any last words, Maja?
No, just thanks for being on the show. That was a really interesting perspective from someone who's actually like living it rather than just kind of, you know, trying to be part of some idealistic fantasy of it.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it a lot.
All right, this is Eric Davis for Expanding Mind. Keep your minds open.